everybody. Bob Claster here, and I'm your host for Funny Stuff, half an hour of comedy brought to you every Friday night here on KCRW. Got some weird mail this week. Definitely some weird mail. Someone calling attention to his personals ad in the LA Weekly. It's always nice to know that. Good luck with that guy. Good luck. Someone else correcting my pronunciation of the phrase Reading Jail, which I didn't pronounce or mispronounce to the best of my knowledge. Weird stuff. Anyway, this week we're going to listen to the comedy of Peter Sellers. You've all seen his movies, but have you heard his records? And if you have, too bad, you're going to hear them again. If you're assuming that you're going to stay listening for the next half hour, which is something I recommend you do, because these are really quite terrific, these records. We will start off with a piece called Balham, Gateway to the South. It's a takeoff on Travelogues, and it was written by Dennis Muir and Dennis Norden from... Frank Muir and Dennis Norden from My Word, if you are a listener to that radio program. And I'll try to fit in some things that I haven't used before in shows about Sellers. Certainly a wonderful, wonderful talent and certainly very well missed. Anyway, we'll start off with Balham.
Balham, Gateway to the South. We enter Balham through the verdant grasslands of Battersea Park, and at once we are aware that here is a land of happy, contented people who go about their daily tasks in truly democratic spirit. This is busy High Street, focal point of the town's activity. Note the quaint old stores whose frontage is covered with hand-painted inscriptions, every one a rare example of native Balham art. Let us read some of them as our camera travels past.
Cooking apples, choice eaters.
A song to remember at the Tandemount Cinema.
A suit to remember at Montague Moss.
Promotions conducted with decorum and taste.
Friday night, bring your own paper. Rally Thursday, Berkeley Square. Viscountess Lewisham and Mrs. Gerald Legg. Up the ruling classes.
This shows the manifold activities of Balham's thriving community. But in quiet corners, we still find examples of the exquisite workmanship that Balham craftsmen have made world famous. Toothbrush holesmanship.
On my forge, I carve the little holes in the top of toothbrushes. It is exciting work, and my forefathers have been engaged upon it since 1957. The little holes in the top are put in manually, or in other words, once a year. I recently had the honor of demonstrating my craft before the owner of ice. He stopped by one day for a couple of words. I did not understand either of them.
So much for Balham's industries. Now let us see a little more of the town. Here is the great park covering nearly half an acre. This is where the children traditionally meet by the limpid waters of the old drinking fountain. A drinking fountain that has for countless years across the vast aeons of time given untold pleasure to man, woman, and child. Beside this fountain, donated by able counselor Quills as long ago as 1928, the little ones sit around a trim nursemaid and listen spellbound and enchanted as she reads them a story.
With one bound, he was by her side. Nora felt his hot breath on her cheek as he ripped the thin silk from...
We are now entering Old Balham. Time has passed by this remote corner. So shall we. But Balham is not neglecting the cultural side. This is Eugene Quills, whose weekly recitals are attended by a vast concord of people. He has never had a lesson in his life. Such is the enthusiasm of Balham's music lovers that they are subscribing to a fund to send Eugene to Italy or Vienna or anywhere. Night falls on Balham. From Quill's Folly, Balham's famous beauty spot, which stands nearly 10 feet above sea level, the town is spread below us in a fairyland of glittering lights, changing all the time. Green, amber, red, red and amber, and back to green. The nightlife is awakening. The El Morocco Tea Room.
Hi, miss.
Yes, what you want?
Pilchards.
They're off, dear.
Baked beans?
Off.
Oh, meatloaf salad?
That's off, too.
Pot of tea?
No tea, dear.
Well, just milk, then.
Milk's off.
Roll and butter, then?
No butter, dear.
Oh, just a roll.
Only bread, love.
I might have just as well have stayed at home.
Well, I don't know. It does you good to have a fling occasionally.
And so the long night draws on. The last stragglers make their way home, and the lights go out one by one as dawn approaches and the bell of St. Quill's Parish Church tolls 10 o'clock. Balham sleeps. And so we say farewell to this historic borough with many pleasant memories and the words of C. Quill Smith, Balham's own bard, burning in our ears.
Broad-bosomed, bold, becalmed, benign, lies Balham, four square on the northern line. Matched by no marvel save in eastern scene, a rose-red city, half as gold as green. By country churchyard, ferny fen and muir, what quills mute, inglorious, lies buried here? Oh, stands the church clock at 10 to 3, and is there honey still for tea?
Honey's off, dear.
Seventy years ago, long before the days of the wireless and the kinematograph entertainment, we young lads had to make our own amusements. Such games as stoning the lamplighter and tripping the muffin man provided harmless outlets for the release of our boyish energy. But the most popular of all our escapades was undoubtedly the one called, quite simply, setting fire to the policeman. Now, this risky operation was invariably carried out at night, since darkness made it less likely that we would be recognized, and at the same time lent dramatic emphasis to the spectacle of the flaming bobby. There were several alternative methods and variations used in perpetrating this jape, but I will confine myself to describing the standard procedure we usually employed. Three carefree young limbs would sally forth of an evening, each one knowing by heart what he had to do. One lad, selected for his fleetness of foot, would be wearing plimsolls. Another, chosen for his golden ringlets and generally angelic appearance, would be clad in a velvet suit. Whilst the third, the strong man of the party, would be carrying a packet of lucifers and an enormous bucket which was half filled with kerosene. The time of the rendezvous with the previously selected but unsuspecting constable, incidentally always a man noted for his good nature and kindness to children, it was planned to the split second. And it was so arranged that the encounter took place in the darkest portion of some ill-lit street. On arrival at the appointed place, the team would spring into action like clockwork. Pretending to blubber, you see, the velvet-clad cherub would approach the officer and murmur, rather inaudibly through his sobs, that he was lost. Whereupon the worthy custodian of the law would kneel or bend down in order to make out what the pathetic infant was saying. Now then, at this precise moment, the bearer of the kerosene-filled bucket would swiftly emerge from the shadows and empty the entire contents of his utensil over the peeler. Then, like lightning, a lucifer was produced, struck, run along the hem of the blue tunic, and, hey presto, yet another policeman in a state of combustion. Well done, lads. However, there's no time to be lost in self-congratulation. The fire brigade must be summoned before the constable can sustain any serious burns. So off like the wind goes our young runner to the nearest fire station, his twinkling plimsolls barely touching the pavement as he speeds on his errand of mercy. Before long, the exciting sound of the horse-drawn fire appliance can be heard in the distance, growing louder every second. Now, this sound, unfortunately, is something that is no longer to be heard nowadays. Pity. It's true, the bell still rings, but where is the heavy rumble of the wheels, jingling of the harness, the crack of the whip, clatter of the hooves, the snorting and the panting of the horses? Oh, they were sounds to stir the blood. Gone, alas, forever. And gone with them, half the fun of the fire. But I digress. Our policeman is by now well and truly alight. See how he lights up the dingy street for yards around. Frantically he blows his whistle and flails himself about the body with his truncheon in a vain attempt to put out the flames. A knot of eager spectators has now gathered, and many a coarse jibe and ribald comment will be made at the expense of the luckless limb of the law. Perhaps a wag in the crowd will cry out something like, "Policemen should keep cool at all times," or an elderly slattern reeking of intoxicants may be heard to shriek, "Smoking on duty, that's what he's a-doing. Ought to have the law on him, that's what." Each sally being greeted by a general burst of merriment from the assembled bystanders. The policeman's plight would seem to be desperate, but help is close at hand. The fire appliance draws up with great commotion, and the nimble firemen leap into action. There is no time to find a hydrant, and the hand pump is operated at once from the emergency barrel, which was always carried. Whilst his perspiring comrades pump valiantly, one brave fellow takes the hose and gets as near to the incandescent officer as the heat of the flames will allow. The flow of water is released, and the stream is directed point-blank at the target. Much too soon, it's all over, and there is nothing to look at save a charred and saturated object, scarcely recognizable as a human being, lying on the pavement. The sightseers, their holiday mood gone, begin to disperse in silence and go about their business. Sometimes, before they went, one of their number would make a collection on behalf of the gallant little lad who had the presence of mind to run to the fire station. On these days it was three tired but very happy youngsters who trudged with their golden sovereigns and half-sovereigns jingling in their pockets, very pleased with their evening's work, and, after all, who can blame them? All this, as I say, took place more than 70 years ago, but even today, whenever I see a policeman, I am still gripped by an almost insane desire to set fire to him.
It must surely, in this day and age, come as something of a shock to the ordinary man in the street to learn that there still exists in this country a sect of people who are still genuinely convinced that the earth is flat. However, and I believe this to be only fair, one should never condemn out of hand the beliefs of others without first investigating those beliefs. And it is for this very reason, despite the fact that more than 400 years have elapsed since Magellan first circumnavigated the globe...
Oh, that word.
Circumnavigation.
No, the other one.
Globe?
Oh, yes, for that word. We never use that. Never. It's forbidden by Article 19 of our charter. I ever use that.
Well, here in the studio, we have Mr. Jeremiah Fuller, the present secretary of the International Flat Earth Association. Now, Mr. Fuller, how many members have you at the present?
Well, sir. Excuse me. When we were first formed, sir, in 1922, membership was restricted entirely to the United Kingdom. And there was only three of us, including myself and my good lady wife.
I see.
But today, even as I speak to you now, we are 15 in number, sir. 15 in number. And this figure embraces two members in Dar es Salaam and five in Hong Kong. Five
remarkable,
in Hong Kong and two members in Dar es Salaam.
Remarkable, quite remarkable. Now, Mr. Fuller, could you tell us very briefly just why you think the earth is flat?
Well, sir, I'm afraid one would need a much longer program than this in order to obviate the necessity of more than a brief resume of all the facets involved.
Mr. Fuller, have you never seen photographs taken from high-altitude rockets which distinctly show the curvature of the Earth?
Well, they're fakes, sir. They are fakes, every one of them. And I'd like to take the opportunity of making it public here and now that there is a worldwide conspiracy of leading statesmen and scientists to discredit our association and all it stands for,
as laid down in its charter for their own secret and wicked purposes.
Come now, Mr. Fuller, this is a preposterous idea. You surely can't be serious.
You can see fit to jeer, sir. But the day of retribution will surely come when you and all the other jibing skeptics who mock us will be forced to repent of your heresy or be cast in the everlasting fire with sackcloth and ashes on your loins. And I say unto
you, Mr. Fuller,
I will be heard, sir. I will be heard. We waited years for a chance like this. As their spokesman of the International Flat Earth Association, I say unto you that the hour of the great reckoning is not so far distant as you might suppose. Because, sir, by detailed studies of the scriptures, my colleagues and I have ascertained that the world be destroyed by fire on the 17th of every month.
But the 17th was yesterday, Mr. Fuller.
All right, I'm a day out then.
Correct me if I am
wrong. I'm a day out, that's all.
Please.
What's the day?
Mr. Fuller, correct me if I am wrong. You have already incorrectly forecast the end of the world on four separate occasions. According to you, we were supposed to have had doomsday in 1923, 1931, 1937, and as recently as 1950.
What are a few years here and there, sir, when measured against the limitless backcloth of eternity? What are they but as grains of sand?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Fuller, but do you mind very much if we get back to the subject in hand for a moment? Now,
grains of sand.
If, as you contend, the earth is flat, what happens if you keep on walking in a straight line?
You'd try and catch me that old one, would you? Try and catch me. But you think you've got me there. Do you know, sir, it is an incontrovertible fact that every year thousands of people is reported missing from home and disappear without a trace. And what has happened to them? I tell you, they have simply walked off the edge of the world. Could anything be more obvious
than
that?
Have you any evidence whatsoever to support this fantastic and unbelievable theory?
Evidence, sir? What more evidence do you need? Verily, sir, I say unto you that when the trumpets shall sound out at Zion and Babylon on Judgment Day, all ye heretics who make sport of us shall be thrown into the bottomless pit together with the painted harlots and brides of Satan who now walk abroad in the streets trying to turn the thoughts of honest men to fleshly lust with their posturings and mincing gait. Posturings and mincing gait.
Please, turn the sound.
Woe, I say unto all these women in their summer dresses and bathing costumes whose rounded breasts and bodies curve in the evil shape in which unbelievers say the earth is curved. Let them be destroyed, even as Sodom and Gomorrah's.
Turn the control.
Woe, I say unto all things as bound and curved. Woe unto footballs, ping-pong balls, tennis balls, billiard balls, cricket balls, cannonballs, marbles, and pawnbroker signs. Woe unto melons, apples, grapefruits, oranges, and lemons. Woe unto balloons, electric light bulbs.
For God's sake, turn the sound off!
Hello. I've been watching you. I say I've been watching you feeding the birds. I
yes.
think you're marvellous. Aren't they sweet?
Yes, sir.
I don't know how anyone can be cruel to dumb animals, do you? I think it's worse than murder because they can't speak. Excuse his somewhat crude attire, won't you? I was catching up with my sunbathing. Hasn't it been gorgeous?
Beautiful weather we have had.
Yes, because I've tan a lot faster in a bikini, you know. But where's the use of frightening everybody to death?
My goodness, you would not frighten me, because when I saw you first, I said to myself, my goodness, what a beautiful woman. I would so very much like to know such a woman of beauty.
Oh, now I'll call that truly gallant. Shall I get up and take a bow?
Please take one, by all means.
You come here often, do you?
Well, I come here quite often, as I said, to feed this bird.
Yes.
Because I love the open air.
Well, it's very nice, isn't it? I mean, it's private without being insulated, if you know what I mean. I can see you're like me. I will not go into a public park and mingle with a hoi polloi.
I quite agree. I like to keep myself to myself.
Oh, aren't there some shocking people about? I mean, even here. Well, there's one woman at our hotel. Well, she's more of a person, really.
Yes.
She fascinates me.
Really?
You know, anything in trousers she graviates to.
Really?
I think you scum. How puerile can you get? And then they wonder, you know, that they end up as Exhibit A.
I'm so lonely, you know, that I want to have conversation with you or someone.
Well, you've only yourself to blame, you know, because I can never resist a true gentleman.
Yes.
My Jove, they hard to come by nowadays. I should know. I was married straight out of the schoolroom, you know, to the most perfect gentleman that ever trod the earth.
Really?
I can see him now. On our wedding day, the tears was rolling down his face. He was so conscious of his trust. He'd promised Pops and Mama. Of course, they thought the world's of me, you know. He'd promised Pops and Mama that I should never want, and my Jove, I never did. He gave me the most smashing home in Avalon Avenue. Do you know Dawson at all?
No, I don't.
Oh, well, they call it the Frinton of East Eight, so that'll give you some idea. Everything a woman's heart could yearn for.
He has obviously left you very well off that, with money.
Well, yes, he did, but mind you, I've got the ample means to buy a splendid home any time I wish. Oh. It was Tufnell's one prayer to leave me comfortably off. But
I'm very pleased to hear that.
They do me very well, you know, at my hotel. Do you know the Ralston at all? It's very, very select, and the manager is a charming chappy, Bill Urquhart, you know, ex-naval type, and the staff's charming too. I'm afraid they spoil me thoroughly, you know. They give me a huge double room on the first floor with a private bath attached. Oh, well, it's almost equally as good as private, because all the others are the Royalston business types, you know. They're almost always gone before yours truly has even opened her eyes.
Oh. Yes.
I'm afraid I'm a bit of a naughty girl like that. I love to lay in my beddy by dreaming my dreams.
I wish that I could share your dreams with you.
Now, that I did not hear. That I have decided completely to ignore. You're not nice to know, you know.
I'm so sorry. I'm so full of enthusiasm to have your friendship, to receive great pleasure from knowing you, that I said a stupid thing like that. Forgive me. I'm so very sorry.
Oh, well, you're forgiven. I was just going to ask you back to Dindin's with me.
Well, I would love to come. Please ask me.
They keep a smashing table at the Royalston, you know. We nearly always have a second vegetable and always croutons with a soup. And if you ever feel like having half a bottle of Bordelais, they practically fall over themselves backwards bringing it in for you. I always say, as long as there's enough to see me out, what happens afterwards, it's sans rien.
Oh, you speak French.
Un petit peu.
Oh, but you have got a very fine accent, you know.
Oh, you, your blue eyes.
No, I mean it. Listen, say this with me. Say this with me. We will speak French together. Are you ready?
Yes.
Voulez-vous coucher avec moi ce soir?
Oh, you rotten egg. I'll set Bill Oakshot onto you.
Oh, you know what it means. You know what it means. You're a woman of the world.
Oh, come on. Let's go over to my hotel and have a talk.
I'd like to come and stand closer to you.
What are you doing?
No, nothing. Listen, I don't even know your name, you know?
Well, shall I tell you a very private name that Tufnell kept for me?
Please, please.
He used to call me Squidgy.
Oh, no. Oh, Squidgy.
Don't you think that's sweet?
It's beautiful for you. It fits you so perfectly.
Do you like this shade of blue?
Yes. What is this?
It's called Blue Toast.
Oh.
Tufnell used to go crackers about me and anything blue. He used to say, Squidgy, buy yourself a blue nightie. Make her eyes look like stars.
Oh. That is so sad, so beautiful.
I believe you're jealous.
Oh. Come along. Now, shall we?
What are you doing?
No, I'm nothing. I'm just helping you from your deck chair.
Well, pick my bag up then.
All right. Come, let us go to your hotel.
Yeah, I don't belong to you yet. You know.
I'm so pleased that I had the chance of meeting you, you know?
This is a blank conceit.
You are the promised kiss of springtime. What makes the lonely winter seem long? You are the breathless hush of evening that trembles on the brink of a lovely show. You are the angel glow that lights a star. The dearest things I know are what you are. Someday my happy arms will hold you, and someday I'll know that moment divine when all the things you are mine. You are the promised kiss of springtime that makes the love.
Bathroom.
Oh, blimey, you can't get a shaving piece in this house. Oh. Lonely winter. Oh.
And there you have it. That'll conclude this particular installment of Funny Stuff having to do with Peter Sellers. And I jumped around from various different records that he made. First we heard Balham, Gateway to Nowhere, from an album called Best of Sellers. Then Setting Fire to the Policeman. I love that. Such a wonderful piece of material by Peter Sellers. And actually, it's from an album by Peter Sellers and Sophia Loren. You can't really hear her on the record anywhere, at least not on that track. Fuller's Earth, from an album called The Dark Side of the Goon, with solo performances by members of The Goon Show. And Shadows on the Grass, Peter Sellers and Irene Handel. And then we closed out with his very touching performance of All the Things You Are, or All the Things You Are, again from the Best of Sellers. Next week is our Father's Day tribute, so I hope you can join me then. That should be a lot of fun, all sorts of different things having to do with Dad and how much we love him and all that stuff. And so that's about it. Until, oh, don't forget the address. Send me some more of this weird mail. Bob Claster, Funny Stuff, KCRW, 1900 Pico Boulevard, Santa Monica, California, 90405. Include a phone number. You'll stand more of a chance of hearing from me. And that's about it. So until next week, this is your host, Bob Claster, thanking you for listening and reminding you to always keep that sense of humor well exercised, because you never know when you're going to need it. Bye-bye, everybody.
Now, the moment you've been waiting for. Listen to The Voice in a Million as Peter Sellers sings George Gershwin.
George Gershwin.